So this is a set of comments on Lenin's text, or this portion of Lenin's text on imperialism. It's a book-length piece of writing, but I chose a section of it. Let me say just right from the beginning, I know that it's a kind of awkward piece of reading and looks kind of difficult to get through, and largely that's because there are so many numbers in it. I mean, it's probably to, you know, Lenin's credit that he actually is doing very extensive research here and sharing, you know, real numbers in order to support his positions about the inherent nature of capitalism, the suggestion that capitalism moves towards concentration, and that if it is the case, which he thinks it is, that capitalism involves a period of competition, it's also of the essence of capitalism. And these dudes, you know, coming from people like Hegel, really do believe that there's like an essence. There's a DNA to capitalism. There's a logic, a rational logic that can be understood about capitalism, not in cross-section, which is, I think, how a lot of liberal and conservative thinkers approach it, but historically. If you try to understand capitalism as an historical process, then you can see that it has a shape, and the claim is in this text that it moves towards monopoly and colonialism and imperialism and world war, ultimately. And there is an insinuation, although it's mentioned, but it's not highlighted a whole lot in this text, also that the ultimate destination of this historical process is to pass through monopolization into global socialization. Anyway, this is his position, and he does back it up with a whole bunch of numbers, but the problem is that those numbers are now 100 plus years old and very boring to read. So I would say, you know, when you go to read it, just try to understand the point that he's making with the numbers. You know, what is it that he's trying to illustrate? In a lot of the early pages, for example, what he's trying to show is that across time, fewer and fewer, what does he call them, enterprises within a particular industry do more and more of the production and extraction within those industries. He's trying to show that, in that case, empirically, monopolization, concentration of production, taking over of production by big and bigger industries is typical of capitalism. And actually, those sorts of things, I don't think that they're pretty hard to doubt, right? I mean, it looks like most industries, if we look around, they might start off with a period of competition, but they end up with something like oligopoly. And these are profound challenges to both the liberal and conservative writers that we've looked at so far. So anyway, what I was meaning to say is you can skim that stuff. Just try and get like what he's saying, and wherever there's not a bunch of numbers, maybe you can take time to read there. So we're looking at a different kind of ideology when we read Lenin than when we read Adam Smith or Milton Friedman, to my thinking, anyway. It's not that we're outside of ideologies. Now, Lenin, you know, like Friedman, I mean, I don't think Friedman thinks that he's writing ideology, that he's like writing something that is, you know, a superficial reflection and reaffirmation of a given system. I don't think he really thinks that way, but it's pretty clear that he is. He's justifying things, and he's using all kinds of like glaringly ideological phrases, like you know, it's natural, or he engages in a whole bunch of like really clear falsifications. I don't personally see that in Lenin or in Marx, really. But this doesn't mean they're not ideology. Now, Marx and Lenin both thought that they were not behaving ideologically. I mean, the whole theory of ideology that I gave you comes from this particular tradition, right? And the whole theory is that ideology is just a part of a ruling system. But Marx and Lenin think that there is an opposite to ideology, which is something that I would challenge and something that gets challenged in the 1960s and on in the political theory I'm familiar with. You know, a key example would be Michel Foucault, Gilles Deleuze, by the time we get to those figures in French thought in the 1960s and 1970s, they don't want to use that term anymore. And one of the reasons they don't want to use it anymore is because in this earlier understanding, there was ideology and then there was science. And Marx thinks he's doing science, and Lenin thinks he's doing science. They think they are speaking objectively. They're saying just how things are, not engaging in some kind of, you know, rhetorical, propagandistic persuasion like would happen in religion, for example. And yet, they are ideologies, and these texts are ideological, and they do they do include a whole bunch of positions which are typical of different ideological persuasions which still exist today. But they're different. You know, in a way, I'll show my cards. You know, I think they're better. It doesn't make them right. There are really clear places where you can see the assumptions, especially in Marx, come out that are like really problematic and not scientific. But there's something to me more persuasive about Marx and Lenin. And the main reason for that, like compare, say, like Lenin writing in 1917 to Milton Friedman writing in, what was it, 1962 maybe? 62? Or even worse, Adam Smith writing in 1776. These capitalist writers, they talk about history a little bit, but if you look at the history that's in Adam Smith, it's completely made up. There's no attempt whatsoever actually to look into real history. That's not what matters. The writing is a justification and an elaboration of the existing system, and historical anecdotes or historical language is present only to naturalize that system. They're not historical thinkers, is my point. And Milton Friedman also, he talks about, I'm trying to think if there's anywhere that he really pretends even to talk about history, but you know, he maybe indicates, I don't even know if it's in there. In both of these thinkers, the point is to describe a system which is conceived as a present system and to, you know, explain its dynamics, to explain its internal functioning, and to justify it in one way or the other. Friedman is not an historical thinker. Marx and Lenin are historical thinkers. And it's not just because I find these statistics in Lenin that I say that. It's that the whole picture that they have in mind is historical. Now, this is not to say that I think that you ought just to believe Marx and Lenin without any kind of reflection. That would be silly, too. Maybe it's to say that if you're going to look for assumptions and ideas about what's natural or ideas about what's true and objective beyond what is proven, maybe you have to look for it in the dimension of the historical. You know, one of the clear ways that that's true in the general Marxist-Leninist tradition, the Hegelian Marxist-Leninist tradition, is the idea that history has a goal. History is moving somewhere. And this is weirdly something shared by a lot of capitalist, colonialist thinkers, and these thinkers who are, at least to a significant degree, antagonistic to that tradition. They both tend to think. Hegel, who ends up being a big reaffirmer of the Prussian military state, and Marx and Lenin, who are these, you know, famous revolutionary opponents of that system, all three of them tend to think that history is moving towards something, and it is inexorably moving in that direction, and that you can understand the necessary progression of history. Now, that to me, in Marx and in Lenin, they draw like a pretty intriguing picture of Western history, of Western colonial history, and especially here in Lenin. I think there is some important stuff about that, which is true. I even think it's true. But the idea that history has to go through these phases involves all kinds of falsification. The falsifications really serve the colonial process more than they serve the revolutionary process and revolutionary goals that these dudes have in mind. They pretend that everything that happens in the development of industrial capitalism in Europe has to happen. Capitalism has to happen. The globalization of capitalism has to happen. The globalization of misery as a result of capitalism has to happen. Globalization of infrastructures which are increasingly socialized or socialistic in their very form has to happen. And together with the global construction of this infrastructure, together with the misery that capitalism itself produces, the ultimate communist world revolution is necessary also. Right? So there's definitely assumption going on in this picture. I mean, maybe the most ideological notion here is necessity, you know, that there's one historical process and it has to have happened. And it involves a whole bunch of colonial presuppositions that I don't think Marx and Lenin generally cop to, but are clearly there. For example, the idea that the industrial society that emerges in Europe is the best one for the world, the most progressive one in the world, and that all other systems, all other ways of life were backwards, antiquated, and doomed from the beginning, doomed to fall under this system, which even though they're critics of all that's going on here, somehow or other they affirm. Anyway, so I don't want to say that this is not ideology. It is. But it's a different variety. And it's also speaking from a different perspective. And you can ask questions about that perspective. So Marx and Lenin, If you just start off on the simple level, they clearly speak in a different way than Smith or Friedman. Smith and Friedman hide labor. Labor doesn't exist, or at least the real conditions of labor, by which I mean people who have to work for a wage because if we don't, we can't eat. They're completely invisibilized in Smith and Friedman, which is desirable because they are the mouthpiece of the owners. That is the discourse of the owners. Marx and Lenin are the discourse of the workers. Now, it's important, first of all, even before I criticize that, which I'm gonna, it's important to recognize they are not the voice of the peasantry. They are not the voice of the slaves. They are not the voice of the indigenous. They are not the voice of the women. You know, it's very specifically the proletariat for whom Marx and Lenin speak, in whose name they speak. And to give them credit, they did devote their lives to a movement on behalf of and in coalition with real proletarians. Proletarian means anybody who receives a wage. Anybody who, and in this picture, it's generally industrial workers are kind of the model they have in mind, right? Marx really organized real workers. Lenin really engaged with real factories of people and real barracks of real soldiers who he helped to organize and who were involved in the Russian Revolution. That's real. We can ask whether they really are the voice and the sole voice and the true voice of those people, because another important thing to recognize is that they themselves are not workers. They are intellectuals. They're radical intellectuals, revolutionary intellectuals. Marx lived off of Engels' money a lot of the time, and Engels had his money from his dad who ran a factory, owned a factory. You know, Lenin was intelligentsia, right? So they are the intelligentsia who speak in the name of the proletariat, and they do work together with the proletariat, and yet on the other hand, they are not exactly the proletariat. And the system that Lenin himself would actually put in place, which first of all carries out what is supposedly going to be the dictatorship over the proletariat, the domination of the majority of workers over the few people who still retain some privilege and anti-worker ideas, that system with the dictatorship of the proletariat actually involved the actual dictatorship of Lenin himself, who was not the proletariat. Nor were, generally speaking, the bureaucrats who surrounded him and who actually administered that society. So we have to be skeptical. So there's a very specific position from which these dudes talk as well. And if you wanted to get ultimately specific, this particular text, written in 1917, it serves a particular function. I think it serves a couple of functions, one intentionally, or a couple intentionally, and one, you know, just because it's still true today to me. Most of this stuff about the progress of capitalism is borne out. And to me, it's crazy that the book is written in 1917 and that you can read it 100 years later and it still makes perfect sense. to me, it sounds like he's talking about today. But the immediate circumstances which occasion the writing of the book are the Russian Revolution and the consequences of the Russian Revolution or the practicalities of the Russian Revolution with respect to World War One. So this is 1917 that the October Revolution happens, right? This is actually the second revolution. First, you have a social democratic revolution earlier in the year, and then you have the hard left Leninist revolution, Bolshevik revolution in October. The immediate consequence of the victory of the revolution is the pulling out from World War One, and this is a war in which I want to say millions of Russians had died, right? At least hundreds of thousands of Russian soldiers had died. Not quite the numbers of World War II, but serious death on the part of working class people. And yet, when the revolution happens, the Bolsheviks immediately cede a very large amount of territory in the West that had been the zone of Russian control, including like Ukraine, for example. Losing one-fifth of the territory, maybe more than one-fifth of the territory that Russia had previously controlled and for which Russia had been fighting. So here's a new revolutionary government which claims to speak in the name of all the working class, and yet which has just pulled out of a war which cost a lot of working class people their lives and needs to justify itself. That's the practical purpose of the book. To say, why would we pull out of this war when so many of you fought and died for it? And the answer is because the war was a capitalist war, not a war for the benefit of working people. And from that, we can move into the content here. And I think you get a really strong analysis. This is maybe the best analysis I know of how to understand World War One. Right? Like, you know, I was always taught, or like when the topic briefly came up, very briefly in my educational career, that it had something to do with Archduke Ferdinand and you know, Serbia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, I don't even know, right? Like we were told these, I think we're often given history in this way, that history is offered to us as nothing but a series of events involving these kind of star characters. And the Marxist-Leninist Hegelian style of looking at history, I think, is so much more profound and so much more powerful and so much more correct, you know, actually intellectually informative, because what they want to do is look at the large scale social and geographical and economic forces as they operate through time. They want to think in terms of systems and the way that these systems unfold and collide in time, and that's how they're going to answer things. So this is in large part Lenin's story. How did we get to World War One? How is it that World War One resulted from the intrinsic characteristics of capitalism? That's what he's attempting to answer. Okay, so basically here, I'm just going to read through these notes. So you can check out the notes. I'm mostly going to say the same stuff. Let's start by defining imperialism. Now, of course, imperialism is, if we used it in a very rough sense, something that has existed in many places in many different times, right? The Romans were imperialistic. The Ottomans were imperialistic. The Aztecs were imperialistic. The Iroquois were imperialistic. They had empires. Maybe not the Iroquois, but they were expansionist, right? And so generally speaking, we think of imperialism as the movement outward of a militarily strong, territorially acquisitive, economic political structure, right? But here we want to have a much more specific definition of imperialism. And what is defined here is the imperialism that still reigns upon the earth today. And I'm reminded of Subcomandante Marcos' definition of neoliberalism as a war between different financial centers. That's what imperialism is too. It's the fact that a few different financial centers in carrying out their continual capital accumulation run into conflict with one another, and you have global conflicts that are ultimately reducible to the striving on the part of these different financial centers to increase their profit and their power by increasing their territory and thus their reach into resources and labor supplies and markets. That's the basic idea here. This imperialism is the imperialism which is now dominant on the face of the earth. It has clear similarities to earlier empires, but we have a much more specific definition here. So here are some of the specifics. Okay, nationally, at the national level, what typifies imperialism, which Lenin here is understanding as an essential, inescapable, and he thought late, he says the last phase of capitalism. Capitalism naturally becomes imperial. And you can see the changes to capitalist economic and therefore social structure on the national scale within a country. But when you see the emergence of financial capital as the dominant form of capital. So if you look historically in the United States, for example, in the middle of the 1800s, and this is the history that Lenin is looking at. He's looking at the U.S., at Germany, Britain, these, you know, key centers of capitalistic development. In the middle of the 1800s, banks exist, of course, but banks are largely playing the role of middlemen. Even by 1900, in the middle of the 1800s, capital, the largest accumulations of value, which are constructing the most powerful operators in the economic field, is still associated with particular industries. It's industrial capital. A certain industrialist in coal, in railroads, in steel, is advancing capital in order to advance enterprises in that industry in order to return profit, which is then accumulating, and this is capital. This is capital that is growing. This is industrial capital, local to a particular industry. The banks are there, but they are facilitating transactions. They're not in charge. However, across the course of the 1800s, banks get more and more in charge. And the fundamental capital, the bulk of capital, first of all, comes practically under the control of banks because they are articulating things for all of these different industries. But then a holding system comes into place where you can have mother, daughter, granddaughter structures where if you hold the majority of the mother company, then you also hold its daughter company and so on. These holding structures are being articulated through banks, and increasingly, objectively, the people who are able to make determinations about what happens within a particular industry are not the people local to that industry, but the bankers who finance or do not finance them. So within a country, you can talk about moving towards imperialism when you move towards the dominance of the financial sector over particular industrial sectors. And we have this in all kinds of complicated ways today, right? You know, corporations even have their own financial wings and do operations that would have been called banking operations in the past, like they run their own credit, for example. Internationally, imperialism involves the cooperation and consolidation of a financial oligarchy. So it's not just the banks in one particular place. These banks are in active and organized relationship with banks across the rest of the world. And then globally, imperialism objectively and historically involves the domination of the global south by the global north. And this happens in a few ways. You have the global north as lender nations, and much of the global south, maybe the entirety of the global south, as borrower nations. Well, I guess there's a couple of exceptions, but then they got rid of Gaddafi. We have colonial imperialism, so like military takeover for economic purposes or with an economic integration. So the North is the colonizer, the South is the colonized. And then there's an economic dimension of imperialism. So you have the What distinguishes earlier capitalism from later, from imperial capitalism? The concentration of production. Very simply, the movement from competition to monopoly, or at the least to oligopoly, or to use Lenin's terms, cartels. You know, we hear cartel and we think drug cartels, which, you know, are the sort of concentrated production that he's talking about. But he wants that term to expand to any and every industry. So, you know, OPEC is a cartel. And this was common language at the time. So this capitalistic process naturally tends towards, it starts with something that kind of looks like competition. You have multiple actors in each industry, maybe thousands. But Lenin tries to show statistically that across time, it's always the case that fewer and fewer operators, big operators, produce more and more in that particular industry, a greater and greater percentage of the product of that industry, and accumulate a greater and greater percentage of the capital with that industry. Very important thing for us to discuss. Capitalism may involve competition at a particular place, a particular time. Generally speaking, globally, he thinks the middle of the 1800s. But I think this is probably something that repeats as new industries emerge. You have a period of competition. But the tendency always is towards concentration. But then there's also a tendency to move internationally. There's this, what do they call it, the law of diminishing returns. If an industry operates only in a particular nation across a period of time, the returns upon its investment opportunities, its profit-making capacity will reduce. And so there's going to be an increased desirability to find new markets. And especially, the problem is that, you know, they're getting greater and greater capital, but how are you going to invest this capital? How are you going to construct very large enterprises, for example, in industrialized England, where a whole bunch of other people have already built factories, where all the land is already bought up, where the financial centers are already humming? There simply are not that many opportunities to invest a massive amount of money and hope to get even more back. So increasingly, it is desirable to take that capital. The capital gets so big that you got to go somewhere else where the the ground is less touched, where the labor is cheaper, where the resources are cheaper. And there's also, because we're talking about a situation where the capital is increasingly bank capital, which are overseeing and making decisions about different industries, there's global usury that tends to happen here. And that does, in fact, historically happen, right? By which I mean the imperialist countries, which are the center of capitalism, right? Imperialism corresponds to capitalism. Capitalism makes imperialism because of its natural tendencies. This is the claim. There's a tendency for those bankers to try to set up massive loans to the global south, and they do carry this out. And as this process goes on, you have the export of capital, you have the ascendancy of a global or northern global financial elite, and they are trying to invest their money across the globe, where increasingly these investments have to compete with other investments. They are looking for, very simply, resources, markets, and labor. That's what capital needs. All these industries require certain resources. And there's a tendency in every one of these industries towards bigger and bigger production. And Lenin actually gives arguments as to why this is the case. You know, as things get bigger, the startup costs get prohibitive for any new operators. There's an economy of scale. If you operate at a certain scale, you don't have to get a certain return. You can get just pennies on the dollar back, and because there's so many different dollars, there's a whole lot of pennies, and you can make a lot of capital that way, a lot of profit that way. But small operators need a greater return. All kinds of reasons that big operators push small ones out. So you have this monopolized, increasingly big industrial set of operators guided by banks. And they get so big, like the oil industry, for example, gets so big that it can actually look at the whole globe, and it's monopolizing also the experts in this particular field. You know, if you want to do your own startup, you know, oil company, well, good luck. All the geologists already work for other people. They cost too much. All the things that you need cost too much. You can't just be like a tiny little startup in the oil industry. Now, if you get a little boom like fracking, okay, there's a moment of competition, as fracking is like a new sub-industry, and then that gets monopolized, right? But the scale of these big operators is so great that they are capable of looking at the entire globe, and with the geologists, for example, that the oil industry employs, they can diagnose that globe and say, here's where the primary deposits are, and here's where, you know, it looks like our technology might be able to find future deposits. We don't know that they're there, but this seems like the kind of place where there could be deposits. And they proceed to compete for those resources. This is imperial expansion. This explains colonialism. Colonialism is driven by the demand for resources, markets, and cheap labor by these big industries. And so the story that he's trying to tell is that, like, global imperialism, you know, obviously it gets going in the 1500s, but there are new waves, you know, so you have a kind of like minerals-based colonialism in the 1500s led by Spain. You have a kind of agriculturally based colonialism in the 1700s and 1800s led by England and France. And then you have this sort of broader resource-based and labor-based and market-based globalizing colonialism of the middle and later 1800s and early 1900s. This is when Africa is taken over. The vast majority of Africa is taken between 1880 and 1900. You go from something like 10% of Africa being colonized to 95% of it, almost everything except for Ethiopia being colonized by 1900. There's this massive land grab. Now think about these years too, right? So this is the claim that, like, because of capitalism's inherent tendency towards monopoly, towards growth, towards financialization, towards export of capital, because you can't make as much money in the home country, you got to go rape somebody else. Naturally, by the logic of this process, and notice capitalism is an historical process in Lenin, very different from like in Smith or Friedman. So it's an historical process with its own laws, which naturally produces expansionism, produces hyperviolence towards the globe, produces the takeover of all these places. And think about it. If you're a capitalist, what do you prefer? If you're, you know, the Rothschilds, or if you're the Carnegies, you know, what do you prefer in terms of your foreign investment? Do you want a place where you have to work out some kind of shifting political alliances with the local elites, and when they turn over power or change their mind, you got to renegotiate all that sort of stuff. But you put a whole bunch of money in, and you have these fields and this, like, you know, very expensive infrastructure, and you built a pipeline, and you have to depend upon the political fluctuations of some distant country. Well, that's not the ideal situation. Much better is to have English or American military forces control the entire country and guarantee your infrastructure, your assets, your access to labor, your access to resources and markets. Capitalism prefers a colony. And if it can't get a colony, it prefers a neo-colony. You know, like some kind of leveraged situation where the military and economic north controls the local governmental apparatus in such a fashion that it might as well be their own. Right, this is what they prefer. And then what happens come 1900? They start running into one another. The European, colonial, imperial, financial, capitalist powers run out of territory that they can take without running into one another's very large industrialized military forces. You know, it was easy to take Africa with the kind of huge military machinery that Europe had generated. And especially once it had also, you know, raped Africa for centuries, producing all kinds of fragmentation and destruction and regression of its culture. It was easy to take Africa until Germany runs into England, for example. There comes a point where global capital can no longer reach outward. And that is the point at which it starts to go to war with itself. The European nations go to war with one another, not fundamentally because of territorial aspirations in Europe, but because of territorial practices across the globe, which objectively run into one another. Now, there's one more feature here, which I think is really interesting and, you know, like lucid on Lenin's part, and he's quoting real people, right? And this is that there's also a process that involves labor, and the people who are going to become settler colonialists in this system, they start off in the home country, and there's a tendency towards unionization in capitalism, right? It becomes obvious that the workers are in one condition and the owners are in another, and that if the workers were to organize themselves together, they certainly do have more bodies than the owners. They could at least systematically withdraw their labor, strike, and prevent capital accumulation from happening while, you know, interest on all kinds of loans still accrues. They can hurt the owners, leverage the owners to raise their wages, right? There's also, you know, general unrest that goes along with living in capitalist conditions. Capitalism is exploitative. It's exploitative in England even before English people exploit the rest of the world. And so the famous comment that Lenin cites from Cecil Rhodes, after whom Rhodesia is named, is that the working class gets so pissed off, they become a real danger to the stability of the entire system. So you got to get rid of them. How do you get rid of them? You send them to go do your colonization. So you take, like, the capitalist system nationally produces an enraged population, which is a threat to that system, but then it takes that population and it uses it to its benefit by sending it to the French, to Algeria, for example, in order to oppress another people, which will eventually become an enraged population as well, right? It's like, you know, go read Frantz Fanon. Okay, this is the process that he describes. I think in a lot of ways it describes our world. And that covers my comments.